I think many of you know that on Tuesdays we're making a long journey, starting last September, through the Gospel of John. It is certainly a voyage of discovery for the speaker, even if it isn't for the listeners. Not least because I started a long journey through Mark some years ago that many of you are doing now, and it has been fascinating to me to see the similarities between John and Mark, which are so often said to be quite different. Of course, there are differences, but the similarities are more striking. Now, normally I don't bring these studies to Sunday morning because there is some overlap. There are a few people amongst our business community who come to us on Sunday morning. But when I have two sermons that are new to prepare on Sunday, I can't always manage it. And sometimes, therefore, I go back to Tuesday and rework that. And so to those who come on Tuesday and are here today, I can only repeat the words of Philippians 3. To me, to repeat the same thing is not irksome to me and is safe for you. The new sermon I have prepared today, of course, is for Sunday night. I hope many of you who aren't able to come on Sunday night follow those with your prayers. We're going through the sort of the Psalms on Sunday night with the particular word kakeh. And we find it to be a revelation as to how deep the concept of happiness is in the Psalms. One might say, if one wanted to put it in a neat way, that happiness, according to the Psalms, is no laughing matter. It's much deeper than that. And tonight we come to a very magnificent Psalm, Psalm 41, which begins, "Happy is the man who considers the poor." A very relevant subject today, and one that we at St. Helens need to look at. So please pray for that tonight with all our students who come to us. Now we turn to verse 30 of chapter 6. "So they said to him," to Jesus, "then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?" One of the themes that underlies the whole of this part of John that is becoming clearer to me every Tuesday is that one of John's concerns in writing, rewriting the story, was to answer the question that had become such a troublesome question in the times of the early church: why didn't the Jewish people believe? See, if you were a Jew and you knew something of your wonderful heritage, many hundreds of years, it would be to you a tremendous stumbling block that when God's Messiah came, all the Jews should be wrong. How could all the people be wrong? It's the same question that people ask when Luther appeared, isn't it? How can this one monk be right and all the church be wrong? So there were many Jews who were teetering on the edge of belief, who yet said to the Christians, how could all our people be wrong when they had been prepared by God's prophets for many generations for just this occasion? And then you're telling us that they all got it wrong. And if they did get it wrong, this was the second question that in a sense was a tougher nut to crack. If the Jews did get it wrong, and if in the crucifixion of Jesus they had done the very opposite of what God had planned for them, well then how was God's will done? How can God say that his purposes for mankind, which were to be fulfilled through the Jewish nation, came to pass through their unbelief? Now those of you who wrestle with Paul in Romans, Romans 9, 10 and 11, three of the most difficult chapters in the Bible, will know that that is the question in his mind when he writes those great chapters. And it is of interest, I think, to know that these are the questions that are in John's mind as he goes over the material that everybody already knows, Matthew, Mark and Luke, and he sits pondering at his study desk and he looks back over the story. He says, how could they have been wrong? How could they have been disbelieving? How could God have allowed it? So there is a very great deal in John about the unbelief of the Jews. And in chapter 6 that we've arrived at on Tuesdays at the moment, we're thinking a great deal about the unbelief of the Jewish people. And here they are in verse 30, like so many unbelievers, asking for a sign. Here is the first of two requests that we're going to look at this morning. Now, if you are a rebound learner, you will know that this request for a sign is a familiar thing. It comes in Mark chapter 8, and the motives there of those who asked for a sign were poor motives. But rather than turn up that verse that is familiar to you, I'd ask you to turn up 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22, where Paul also talks about this perpetual desire of people for proof. One of the greatest of Paul's statements, I think, in the early part of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 22. It puts it in a nutshell. It summarizes what Paul saw in his missionary journeys, and actually is very true for today. Verse 22 of chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians. Jews demand signs, that is miracles, and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. The Jew, in other words, asks for things that he can see, and the Greek asks for the whole thing to be proved to him. Very characteristic if you think of their different civilizations. It would be a very strange thing, therefore, if we could get through 8 nights at Cambridge University without someone demanding for a sign. And I no doubt that demand was made very often to the 50 assistant missioners in the various colleges. A great army of Christian workers were there last week. And once during the 8 nights, the request was made to me. It was quite a small one, and it didn't greatly upset things. But halfway through one of the second talks, the instruction talk, the after meeting, I think the 3rd night, one young man lifted up his hand in the middle of my sentence and said, "But you're avoiding the main issue. You haven't proved to us the existence of God." And that is precisely, of course, a request for proof. A request for a sign. A statement that we can't take God for granted until I have proved that, instead of getting on to anything else. All I could do for him was to offer him at that juncture, Psalm 14, verse 1, "The fool has said in his heart there is no God." Because that is all that the Bible has to say about the existence of God. It takes it for granted from the first page until the end. And simply assumes that anybody who disbelieves in the nature of a creator is, in biblical terms, a dunce and a fool. Not perhaps very satisfactory as an answer to him, but the only one I can give to the Bible in a short time. When you give that kind of answer, of course, many people think, yes, there he is again. He was ordained to be a clergyman, knowing that he would stand 6 foot above contradiction every Sunday of his life, surrounded by a door that was shut from the hordes that come up, in this case any more than children that love coming up here, and that therefore he can get away with saying those kind of things, whereas if you were on Tower Bridge, like Lord Sophie used to be, you couldn't get away with it. But when we say this, of course, we are not saying that there is no evidence and that no evidence is necessary. Come back then to John chapter 6, verse 30, and you will see something said here which is of very great importance for John. So they said to him, "What sign do you that we may see and believe you?" Now, notice, please, the language they use and that John records. They asked that they might see and therefore believe. What they said is, "You tell us that if we believe, we shall see, but we're very practical, down-to-earth people. We won't believe unless we can see." Now, those of you who know John's Gospel know that this is one of the very great themes of this Gospel. I want you to go back to chapter 1, verse 14, where he deals with this matter of sight and faith. And it is John's purpose to prick this particular bubble of conceit and to say right from the beginning that God has given people in the incarnation something to see. The very fact that God became flesh, and incarnation simply means enfleshment, the fact that God became flesh gives us something we can see and touch and handle. So verse 14, just a characteristic early verse in John, "The Word became flesh." That's an extraordinary phrase, isn't it? "The Word of God became flesh and blood, and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. And what? We have seen, beheld his glory." So he says, right from the beginning in the Gospel, that in the fact that God became flesh, there was something to see, and that therefore God is not calling upon men to believe unless they have seen. Turn to the end of the Gospel for the same theme, chapter 20. Chapter 20 of John, verse 8. If you've heard me say this before at an Easter sermon, please bear with me. It's so important, because this misunderstanding is so widespread today. It is taken for granted in much evangelism that the evangelist is asking people to take an existentialist leap into the dark, that there is no real evidence, and that we've just got to believe. And you've heard me say many times from here that that kind of leap in the dark will only give you a broken ankle, or rather, in the end, a broken faith. John 20, verse 8. The other disciple reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw, and what? Believed. Verse 18, Mary Magdalene went and said to the disciples, I have seen the Lord. Verse 20, when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they, what? Saw the Lord. See, there's no doubt about it. You're not asked to believe in the resurrection without sight. It isn't your sight, of course. It would be a ludicrous absurdity to ask God to go right through the business of bringing his son down to earth every generation, to go through the whole business of the empty tomb in every generation. God assumes that we will accept the evidence of rational people, many of whom saw it. John, Peter, Mary Magdalene, the disciples in the upper room. And so when we get to John saying that unless he personally sees, he won't believe, he's rebuked. Not because seeing is wrong, but because so many people have seen and have believed. And it's all summed up in verse 30. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe. You see these signs. Here are the people asking for signs. And what John says is, I have thousands of signs. And when I asked my wife to bring a cup of coffee and keep the children out of the room, the 6 hours that I might start writing them down, I realized that if I was going to write more down, I'd never write to 100 books. So I decided to select some. Select very, very few, comparatively speaking, but they are magnificent signs. And these are given that we may believe. So there is no belief in the Bible without evidence. No belief without sight in the first generation. We are to believe their testimony of what they saw, because that is a reasonable thing by which all history goes on today. That's why you learn in the history. If it weren't possible for people to report what they saw, then you wouldn't read in the history. Back then to John 6. Now let's look at the context. Now you see, if you look at the beginning of chapter 6, you see that it's one of the greatest of all the signs, if not the greatest, of all the signs that Jesus did. The feeding of the 5,000. Of course, if you want willfully to destroy this testimony, you can. Like the teacher at school where I taught in the university vacation. He was great at explaining these ways. I often tell you his strange ways. Actually, I don't think he did have a clever way of describing this one, but you'll find a clever way in one of William Barclay's commentaries, in which he says that everybody had their morning lunch tucked away in their pockets. And they were determined that nobody else would get it. And when they saw the generosity of the disciples sharing their allowances, everybody was shamed into sharing theirs. Now, if you think that anything like that happened, then A, you must be a cuckoo, and B, you have to say that these people were liars. That they were quite incapable of discovering what actually happened. And that they sat down in order to deceive all succeeding generations with a ridiculous story, which is actually a matter of people being shamed into sharing what they brought out of their 11s. You can believe that, you can believe anything. Which is what you have to believe if you become an unbeliever. Not too Irish to put it like that. Now here is the sign of the feeding of the 5,000. Let's go on then to see if there's a clue, a little further clue, as to what they're really asking. So let's go on to verse 31. In the context then of one of his very greatest signs, they say to him, what sign do you do that we may see and believe? What work do you perform? Well, verse 31 tells us what they're looking for. Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Now, it isn't very easy, is it, to be quite sure what they're really asking. But I'm going to make a suggestion. Everyone who has studied this himself. It seems to me that they are asking Jesus to repeat what Moses did in the wilderness that we read of in the first lesson. That story is one of the greatest stories in their history. That's where they became a nation. Just because God gave them that great leader, and because he held them together and walked them through that terrible experience out into the freedom from Egypt, that he became their leader and they became a people. And their minds are fixed so naturally on their great heritage, on the good old days. And what they're saying is this, look, we know what we are. We are the people of Israel. We are God's people. And we know the leader that God has given us, Moses. We know our heritage. If you want to change all that, then what are you going to do that will measure up to our history and to the greatness of Moses? Now, there is something very, very, very natural in that, isn't there? You see it somewhat, don't you, in the publications of the Banner of Truth, who, and I have read many fine books that they've published, but there's a tendency in the publishers of the Banner of Truth to publish the stories of the great 18th century giants, to publish their sermons. And if you think sermons go to sermons along, I tell you, if you went to live in the 18th century, you would come here for election relief, because those went on for an hour and a half or 2 hours. But they were great days. And I get the impression sometimes that the Banner of Truth publishers are publishing these things again and again, not because anybody could possibly preach like that today, for if I read you their sermons, you'd all walk out of church straight away. Because they are couched in the language of another time, even though they speak the truth. But because so often all of us want to say that the past is better. Now, I confess that that is congenial to me. That's why I like many of the Banner of Truth books. Let me put it this way, I find very uncongenial the modern view of many people, which you see mirrored in many of the paperbacks you see on Christian bookstores today, that nobody really knew anything about Christian worship or spiritual gifts until the last 30 years. Now, there are many young Christians who talk like that, aren't there? Everything is new, they say. The church has rediscovered all these things. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is very uncongenial, because the church life and the Christians I see today are, in my view, pigments compared to the church life of the men of the 18th century. It seems to me we have no idea from what we have fallen, and therefore to boost the 20th century is not a congenial thing for me personally. I may be wrong with this. What I'm saying is it is very natural, isn't it, to look back to the past and to see these men as giants. They may not have been. We may be quite wrong. Maybe if we went back there, we should find that they had clay feet just like anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you is that I have sympathy with what the Jews said. They said, look back to our great past. What have you got to show with that? Well, all he had to show was 12 men. Very little success. Most people unbelieving. Let's go on to see his answers, because this may give us a clue as to what is really in their minds and in his. Verse 32. Jesus then said to them, truly I say to you, first of all, it is not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven. Now that seems to support the interpretation that I'm giving you. You see, they had erected Moses into an almost superhuman giant. Was it not right that John Pollock had the right to produce a biography of the great missionary to China, Hudson Taylor? Because the official biography of Hudson Taylor, their great book, was an unreal book. None of his thoughts shared. He appeared to live in a completely different world from anybody else. He conquered apparently everything by faith and never had a row with anybody. So John Pollock rewrote the story of Hudson Taylor, not in order to say that he was a pygmy, but to say that he was a human being. Now surely they had done something like that with Moses. They had lifted him up to an absurd height. And Jesus corrects this by saying it is not Moses who did this great sign. He goes on, my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. Now notice this, my Father. Who gave them the bread in the Old Testament times? It was God. Who is this God? Jesus claims that he is my Father. It seems as though he is suggesting you've lost touch with the God of the past, the God of history. You now cling to your history and to Moses and your heritage, but you lost touch with God. And that could be said, couldn't it, of many churches. This could be said if there is some glory in the 18th century like me. It's my danger. The danger is, isn't it, to glory in the great men of the past and lose touch with God in the present. He says, my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. And that is the tense of the verb. They say, Moses gave them bread from heaven, or rather Jesus reports that. That lies in the past. But my Father, notice the present tense, gives you the true bread from heaven. Let's go on, verse 33. This is even more striking. For the bread of God, I love that phrase that is, by the way, the bread of God is that which comes down from heaven, or more literally, he that comes down from heaven and gives bread to, what? Is there a mark? One of the great signs in John's Gospel, one of the great themes in John, who gives bread to life to the world. Now that, I think, shares the movement away of these Jews of Christ. You see? They are clinging to their heritage, and they're saying, you must show us a sign if we're going to accept you as a leader to deliver us, because they must have been well aware that just as they needed deliverance in the wilderness, they needed it there from the Romans. So they say, you see, if you want to be our leader, you've got to come and do the same things. And in his answer, what he shows is that he doesn't want to be their leader unless they will reconstitute the whole of their calling from God, which is not a calling to be Israel for Israel's sake, but which is to spread this privilege of knowing God to the whole wide world. It's a quite remarkable answer, isn't it? It wasn't Moses, it was God. And that God is my Father. And that Father is sending the true bread into the world now, and that bread is not for Israel only, it is a universal bread for the whole wide world. Now, the position we've got to, I think, can only be well expressed in the words of 2 Timothy 4. So would you turn to Paul's last statement ever? You'll find this on page 200 in the Rome Bibles, and I think the same in the Little Red and Green Bibles. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Look at chapter 4, verse 3. This is the Apostle Paul making his last charge to Timothy and telling him what to expect. 2 Timothy 4:3. The time is coming, he says, when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own likings and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. But in that case, be steady and go on to your work. Now, isn't that remarkable? You see, if you put it in the context of the Jews wanted people who would speak what they wanted to hear. What Jesus was saying, they didn't want to hear. They wanted to capture God for their own sake. God had to be their God, serving them. Jesus wanted to bring them out of that, to realize that they must serve God to take the truth into the world. So they wouldn't listen to him because he did not fit what they wanted. They wandered away from the past and into myths. In other words, they wanted God to serve them. And that's very characteristic of the church, isn't it? We want God to serve our heritage and our past. Where I said in Cambridge last week, there is a rather painful sign of that. Perhaps not terrifically important, but there's a church next door to the house where I was living, which is not wanted by anybody. But it happens to have a fine Victorian exterior. And so a group of people whose desire to maintain Victorian things, of course, is very admirable, no doubt, have fought to maintain the church standard. Though in fact, the ground is very badly wanted for furtherance of Christian purposes, in particular the building of a vicarage. Now, I don't mind people keeping Victorian things up. like St. Pancras Station, because I too like many signs of Victoriana. What I think is sad is when it is done in the name of the church. When it is done by devoted church people who say, we must maintain this. For what? Very difficult to see. You see, there is something in our heritage that easily becomes a kind of idolatry. The only people who are true to that in the past are being true to God and will maintain his cause. And we have to be very careful of that. If we do it on archaeological grounds or on artistic grounds, well then, let us do that. But let's not muddle it up with the cause of Christ. And derelict Gothic churches are no help to Christ. It would be lovely anyway if that bomb would destroy this old building, wouldn't it? There are plenty of 15th century arcades to take its place. Then we could have a modern building that could serve the cause of Christ. To idolize this kind of thing is not to serve, is it, the cause of Christ? He is wanting the bread of God to spread to the whole world. That's our chief concern. Let us do other things in that context, and we shall be kept from folly. Now, coming back to John chapter 6, let's see how that request goes on. Well, of course, they're completely bewildered by this, and in verse 34 they say, well, Lord, give us this bread always. It's very difficult to know what they thought he was going to give them. It's rather like the woman, isn't it, in chapter 4, who said to Jesus by the well, please give me this water that I don't come hither to draw. And she was like many poor people at the moment, all she had was a tap. And she would like to have running water laid on. And she had some idea that Jesus would give her that. Well now, let's look at the answer, which is where I will lead you today. It's a very remarkable answer. Give us this bread is really another way of saying, show us a sign. In verse 35, Jesus said, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger. He who believes in me shall not thirst. Now you see what he is saying here. This is one of the great disclosures of Christ, one of the great I am. I am is the divine title for the Old Testament. God had said, I am who the I am. Christ said, the I am is with you. I am the bread of life. I stand in front of you. If you come to me, you will never hunger. And if you believe in me, you will never thirst. So what he is saying is this, that the evidence for God's mission through me is not to be found in any strange miracles, but is to be found in myself as I stand before you. Now, I think this is one of the most important things that John ever says. The evidence for Christianity is Christ. It is not any miracles that Christ may do. It is the man, Jesus Christ himself. If I listen to his teaching, if I face up to his presence, if I see the signs that he does do, and I don't believe in him, there is no more evidence for me to be given, because that is the full light of day. It's absurd to ask God to bring me some candles from the past, when I have electric light in the present. I don't have electric light, I have sunshine. When I went to Cambridge, I decided that that would be the best way to present the truth in the Guildhall night by night. And the Christian Union Committee agreed that this is what we should try to do. That we should present Jesus from the Gospel of Mark as it happened. Because that is the very best proof and sign that God is alive in the world today. Now I don't want to say necessarily that I did it entirely right, because of course I made many mistakes. But I want to finish by reading you a letter I had from one of the assistant missionaries this week that to me was a great encouragement. If you should think that it is just a boost for the mission, and there was a boost to his encouragement, I can tell you. I should tell you that the end of the letter also takes me to task about other things, but I'm not going to read you that. I want to thank you for your Marken expositions. They were much enjoyed, and it was a great relief to be able to urge people along to the Guildhall, knowing that they would hear teaching, not appeals, truth, not techniques, Mark, not the missioner's hobby horses. Long term, I believe the effect of that will be great. Christians will see that mission, evangelism, the preaching of the gospel, really do make sense. And not a few of Screwtape's gambits will have to be shelved. While non-Christians who came to hear one or more of the addresses will not be making the existentialist leaps into who knows where some evangelistic addresses lead to. In, and then he names his college, three profess clearly within the week. And of those three, all went to three or more addresses. No leaps into anywhere in their cases. Then he tells me how they came to Christ. He says, it was very thrilling to see the three in this college, wise men, rash men, not without emotion, yield to the Lord they had heard about. Now that is the answer, isn't it? The man who on Tuesday night put up his hand and said, prove it. You can't prove God in Christ like that. The truth of God is put in a person. If I ask you whether you trust a person, I'm asking you a very different question than when I ask you, do two and two make five, or not, as the case may be. When God wanted to show us the final truth that is at the heart of the universe, he didn't send a philosopher, or a mathematician, or necessarily a book on logic. He sent us a person. And Jesus says to her, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so here, in this verse, he says, I am the bread of life, if you come to me.